Welcome to the Loyalty Talk, the podcast about loyalty marketing. I'm Michael Bietenharder, and I have inspiring and practical conversations with experts from the CRM and loyalty world. The podcast provides insights into current topics, success factors, challenges, and trends in loyalty marketing. In episode number 35 of the Loyalty Talk podcast, I talk to Rasmus Hulind, author and Chief Experience Officer of Agilic, a marketing automation software company. This episode is also a premiere, as it is the first in which we speak in English. In the Loyalty Talk, Rasmus gives a definition of personalization and explains the concept of the bow tie of personalization, which is the framework of his book Hello First Name. We also talk about how personalization and customer loyalty work together, what the biggest challenges are for companies and how they can master it, and what changes in personalization with generative AI. Rasmus also shares his favorite examples and gives advice on how companies can get started with personalization. Hello, Rasmus. Welcome to the Loyalty Talk podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for your time and for being a guest today. Well, today we have planned to talk about personalization and customer loyalty. But before we dive into this topic, let's first do the usual introduction of the guest. So could you say a few words about yourself, Rasmus, and your career, and also a few words about Agilic, the company
you're working definitely. For? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so first things first, my name is Rasmus Hulind, and I am Danish, as you might be able to hear. I've been working with agencies, mostly actually in my career, before joining Agilic, which is a software company. And I joined Agilic 8 years ago. Before that, I was with the Danish digital agency called Magnetics, which was then acquired and became known as Merkle. And so I've been working with digital marketing and I would say personalization even for almost 2 decades now, even though it's I'm having trouble admitting it. So, but that has led me to also off. I've also authored a few books on the topic, which I think is probably what sets my career apart from most people. Not that many people get around to writing books. My first one I did in 2015, which was then actually republished in an international version in 2019. It's called Make It All About Me. It's on Audible for audiobooks for those who want to listen to it. And then last year I published Hello First Name, which is a book about personalization, which I expect that we'll be talking more about later. But Agilic is a software company, so it's obviously the best marketing automation tool in the world, along with many other competitors, obviously. So we're a software company basically. And we have our main part of our business in the Nordics, but also having quite a few clients in DACH. That's where we are and who I am.
Well, thank you. You just mentioned that you're an author and you wrote several books. How did you came up with the idea of becoming an author?
Yeah, good question. I think it was born out of frustration, really. So the idea of doing my first book was when I was with the agency, and I think I was a bit frustrated. Remember, this was in 2014, even so, 10 years ago. I was frustrated with the clients not really taking it all the way to like full implementation. So projects always got halted. So if there was a customer loyalty program, or there was a marketing automation project or a personalization project, that our clients didn't take it all the way because they ran out of budget, or they ran out of management support, or they ran out of patience or whatever, and they ran out of ambition. And so the projects that we pitched and the concepts were never really taken to the fullest, and I think I was curious to sort of explore what does good really look like. So if we didn't have all these obstacles, and if we were able to take it all the way, what would reality look like then? And that's when I started actually writing my first book. Also from a, like a personal development standpoint or point of view. It was also a way of doing something that I see not that many other people do. So many take an MBA or like a extra education. So really this was also a way for me to do something that was a bit maybe out of the ordinary. And I've always enjoyed standing out. So doing that as a sort of a career move, I didn't think at the time that it would be such a tremendous change in my career, but it turned out to really change things for the better. And I found out that I really enjoyed writing. I enjoyed the process and I enjoy the network that it's building as well.
Oh, cool. That sounds all very easy, but I can imagine that there were a few struggles or a few challenging becoming an author. What were the most challenging topics?
Yeah, you bet. Most challenging, I think probably finding the time to focus, finding enough time to focus. I think that was probably one of the most difficult things. I think on top of that, I think also, you know, especially when I look now at the third book that I published, actually spending enough time promoting the content. So realizing that once that you're done with the main part of writing, first there's a huge editing part, which is really painful, but makes the book so much better. And then there's the thing about once it's released that you still need to spend time with the content. You need to repurpose it. You need to do it as we're doing now, talking about it. You need to promote the content. Mm-hmm. You need to be continuously reminding the audience and the market out there that this content exists, or people will simply not pay any attention to it. So I think those have been the most challenging things. Here, I mean, it becomes easier, obviously, because now I realize that I need to spend a lot of time on the editing part, and I realize that I need to promote the content more. And I think especially with the last part, it just become so much better. Also, the last book was the book before this book was released in 2019. I don't think if you can imagine a worse time to publish a book. So just before COVID-19. So not so much promotion going on and keynote speaking and such while everything was closed.
Yeah, everything was shut down. And but people were digital, so you could digitally promote.
I think I could, but I was I had to take my mind and put my effort into other things because the world was such a crazy place. I should and could have done probably more with podcasts and stuff like that, digital promotion of it, but I didn't, so I learned.
You can always learn something, even in times when there are some crises.
And if you don't, then you die, I guess.
So. Yeah, that's right. And what role does the podcast play in promoting your book?
Yeah.
Is it like a promoting tool or is it a marketing tool or is it more like special content?
I think it serves many purposes. First of all, it was so the idea of doing my podcast, which is called the Hello First Name podcast. The idea of doing it was because I realized that I personally stopped reading physical books. And I mainly listen to new books because that way I can enjoy it on my home to and from work or while I'm mowing the lawn or doing gardening or whatever. And I realized that this was probably also the case for many other people. And so I decided that I wanted to record the book as an audiobook. With my last book, I hired an actor, a voice actor, to do that. And I didn't want to do that this time because I felt it a bit alienating that some American was, even though in perfect English, was recording my book, because I really wanted to create more of an intimate connection with my audience and with my readers and my listeners. So I realized that I needed to record it myself in my own voice, but it's also super boring to record your own book, just sitting there in a small room that's probably a bit too hot and reading the content that you honestly feel maybe that you're done with. To some extent, at least. So I could only bear recording an audiobook chapter every other week. And so I decided, why not give the content away for free? And then every other week, I would have either an audiobook chapter or a discussion of that audiobook chapter with an expert such as yourself, Michael. Thanks for joining the other week. So, I've seen a pretty interesting guests actually coming to the podcast. So, for instance, That was the SVP of e-commerce, Jesper Damsgaard from Pandora, just to name one of them. I had Mike Anderson, who's one of the founders of Tealium. And so pretty interesting guests, I should say. So it's become a multi-purpose thing with the podcast, and it's also a learning experience for me because I'm having these discussions about personalization with different experts, and having them on a podcast doesn't mean that I don't learn from them. So I actually get to learn a lot, also from discussing the topic with you.
Yeah, that's the same with me. I always learn something from my guests. So I'm curious what you will tell me within the podcast now or within the next minutes. Well, let's talk about your current book, which is called, you just mentioned it, Hello First Name, exactly. Profiting from Personalization. Well, obviously it's about personalization. And the term personalization, I would say there are like many or various different definitions. Yeah. If you talk to 10 different people, they will give you 10 different definitions. Could you give us as an entry point just your definition of personalization as you define it for yourself and, of course, also in your book,
Hello First Name? And I'll give you that definition, and then I'll tell you why we cannot use it for anything. Because I think you're right, definitely, first to sort of second that, that everybody believes that they know what personalization is if they've been working in marketing. And indeed, it's hard to do any marketing without doing at least a little bit of personalization. So in a sense, everybody understands it, but they're using it in very different ways. But the definition of it, as we've come in the book, goes as the following. So we say that personalization is a distinct communication tactic that aims to create better immediate and future business value by showing or hiding specific content to recipients in a way that is expected to align with insights into their explicit or inferred preferences. So, so changing the customer experience for the better based on what you know about the customers and what you think they want to do. That's basically it. And that's also very, very broad, which is actually kind of why we cannot use it for much other than saying that if this is the definition that we go with, then almost all things within marketing can be labeled as personalization. And that makes it hard for us as practitioners to use it for building better customer experiences because, then suddenly everything is personalization. What's the point then and how can I become clever?
But then you came up with this bow tie framework in the book. I suppose this is based then on this definition because it's also quite a broad framework. But why did you choose a bow tie?
That's a good question. Why did I choose that? I think I was playing around with the definition of personalization. I was trying to deconstruct it. And I had this feeling that on one end, you have all the... So if you have like a personalization pipeline, so then you'd have data coming in from the one end. So a lot of data is created from your loyalty program or from your products or from the digital channels that you are talking to people with. And somehow that needs to be funneled in towards what actually matters for the one individual customer. So expect like one funnel until you then have a touch point where you meet the customer. And what would you then present the customer with? That would have to be some kind of content. And that there can be many forms of content, and you can express that in many different creative ways. And ultimately, you'd need to execute that through some kind of channels, communication channels. So I had this idea that the funneling of the data into actually becoming customer insights, and then at the touch point you have with the customer, that's where you start to unfold it in a creative way. So thinking about how can we inspire this customer? How can we have it engaging? How can we make it creative? Which content feeds, as in product feeds or article feeds or whatever content feeds that we sort of have access to, can we use to further make our message come across? And that was the idea, actually. And also found that there's been so much discussion about personalization and especially data and data insights. So the rise of the CDPs and data management platforms and customer data platforms. There's so much about this that I think as a tendency, the content part has been overlooked. So I really wanted to bring that back into the equation. So that's why they have the bow tie of personalization, which I call it. So because it resembles kind of like a bow tie. You have the one end of the bow tie, which is like the insights part, which is what the data ultimately becomes if you're able to refine it and make sense of it. That would either be your customer segments, or it would be your more fluctuous moments of truth, what's going on right now, what is the intent with the customer, or what do we believe that they should pay attention to right now, even though it's not necessarily something that's on their mind. So it's a subscription that is ending, or a special product that they like that is now on sale, or whatever. So that was sort of the insights part of it. And the content part, the other part would be your creative messaging. That's one corner of the bow tie. The other would be your content feeds. And really, I wanted... So in the same way that you are tying your own bow tie, and I think all the gentlemen listening to this can probably testify to the fact that this is not an easy thing to do. So when you arrive at the party, you want your bow tie to be even. So you don't want to be too heavy on the content side, with one end sticking out and the other one being very small. So being too heavy on the insides, not having the content to back it up, that will ultimately lead to no personalization, because no content, no personalization. And the other thing holds true as well. Definitely. So you don't want to be too heavy on the content side with having, you know, spend too much time on the creative and too much time on the content feeds, but having no idea, no insights about whom to show it to, because that will arrive at no personalization either. So you want to have a balanced way of balancing your customer insights with your customer content, and for those reasons, I think the bow tie is or the bow, if you want a more feminine version of it, that also makes sense. It's a beautiful metaphor for keeping it simple, and also understanding the four different corners of the bow tie that you should pay attention to to keep a balanced way of in your customer experience.
Yeah, really an interesting framework, and also. Make some advertising now for the book. I think what I love about the book is that it's really easy to understand. It's not like a lot of other books on like personalization, CRM, and so on. They are like quite complex, more like from a theoretical point of view. And yours is really readable, easy readable, and also with a lot of examples from companies. That's what I found really, really interesting. Yeah. So it's a hard work.
Yeah, doing something short and simple always takes a very, very long time. And so that's why a few words on the creation process. I did a lot of expert panels talking to practitioners, because I was talking also to scientists and to people that were doing PhDs on the term of personalization, really wanting to crack this definition. And I realized that if they're doing this, what is it then that I'm doing? Because they'll probably end up with a more fine academic definition of it. But I really found that what was needed was a more practitioner's view on this, which is where the bow tie personalization came into this. So I spent a lot of time with the problem before coming up with a solution. So I wanted to make the bow tie a tool for practitioners where they can look at different personalization projects and really find out what to focus on and what to emphasize when they are going into, for instance, making a big campaign and wanting to personalize that, or working with marketing automation. What is it then that you should focus on for making the customer experience as good as possible there? Or if you're working with, for instance, on-site website personalization or in-app personalization, what is it then that you need to focus on in order to maximize the profit from your efforts? And that was the idea. So creating this tool that is really plastic for practitioners to use, and where they can have unambiguous conversation about what personalization is, and not misunderstand each other, being able to have conversations about this with their colleagues, but also talk unambiguously with their senior management, for instance.
You just gave me a few topics now to ask further questions. First, I have to decide which one's the next. Maybe speaking of like examples or companies, yeah, you have a lot of expertise, you said before, like 20 years in the market. And also for your book, you talk to a lot of different companies. You did this, as I understand it, like you did this focus groups.
Expert panels.
With experts from companies. So you've seen a lot of examples in companies. when you compare the DACH region, like Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, compared, for example, to the Nordics, which is your home turf, or to other markets like UK, so where do you see the DACH market compared to these other markets when it comes to personalization?
Yeah, that's a good question, and maybe also a bit dangerous one. So not really trying to offend anyone here. I do believe that the best companies in the UK are doing really well in terms of personalization because they've been working with this for so long. So ever since, you know, the Tesco loyalty programs, I think even back from the 80s and maybe even before that. So they've been working with personalization for decades. And they also have the scale to create really good stuff just by doing actually small things. But they've been working with this so long that they're actually probably more advanced than most countries. What I realized is that in the Nordics, we don't enjoy the same amount of scale on our loyalty programs. So what we need to do in personalization and within loyalty is that we need to be super efficient. So really making sure that the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak. And that's why I think the Nordics is a brilliant market or a brilliant region for really finding out what is it that works and what should you do before that. And that's kind of what I have baked into the Hello First Name book. And when I then compare that to the German market, I think that the German market has the same advantages of scale as the UK has, and even as the US has. On the other hand, I think there's a higher degree of consumer skepticism within Germany, and that has somehow made it. I think that the Germans have gotten into this a bit later than, for instance, the UK has, with good reason, because really wanting to do things right and not freak people out and not and really taking those marketing and those data consents seriously. So that's actually a good thing, but it also means that the level of personalization that most Germans would probably experience from the brands that they love probably has a tendency to be a bit lower than what you'd see, for instance, in the Nordics and in the UK. So, but I think important thing to stress is that really, I think that is anchored in a sound consumer skepticism and in data privacy, which is essentially a good thing, and what keeps Europe. So on that note.
And I think I would agree with the points you mentioned, and I think Switzerland and Austria, the other two countries in the DACH area, they have the similar problems like the Nordics. They don't have that scale. They are smaller countries, so you have to be really efficient. Yeah. So would you say like scale is the most important thing when you talk about personalization? Or
no, I wouldn't say so. But depends on what you want to do with personalization. I mean, scale is obviously fantastic when you want to earn money from personalization. But I think the most important thing with personalization is really trying to figure out what is appropriate for each customer. And then obviously starting with the messages where you have the largest scale in terms of, I mean, obviously you'd find the message that suits most people first, and then you'd go on to the next message that maybe doesn't cater to such a big audience but still works. So scale is good, but I think really tying the insights together with your content before applying the channels, I think that's one of the most important things, because really today everything is omnichannel, right? So we as consumers, we are across all channels. And what I see is preventing a lot of companies from really breaking through the glass ceiling from one level of maturity and personalization to the next. So for instance, going from, you know, simple product recommendations on site and simple Hello First Name personalization in email newsletters, really breaking through to the next level is really about making sure that you connect the insights with the content before you don't build that into a channel necessarily. Have that at sort of an omni-channel level, because that will allow you to scale across different channels. So there's one thing that's for certain, is that you won't be able to meet all customers in one single channel. It's not like the old days where you can just put everything on TV commercials. So you really need to have that content and have those insight at an omni-channel level or central level. And I think that's one of the most important things.
But in essence, you say that like the smaller scale countries, maybe there you have to stop earlier with personalization efforts, because you reach the point where there is no further profit. You reach this point maybe earlier than in a large scale country like UK, USA. Or
if I was a German company, for instance, I would really like to see the sort of Nordic efficiency spread out on my large German customer database. I mean, that would be... That would be crazy, the effect that because then you'd get both the efficiency and the effect. So that would be the dream
of every
and indeed we are trying to do that. That's also part of the mission here at Agilic, that we're trying to bring personalization to millions, and I think with the platform that we have, which is really good, and the scale of the businesses in Germany, I think that's within reach, because it's really not that complicated once you get it right from the get-go.
And in Germany, maybe it just come up to my mind now, that's maybe another point why they are a little bit behind in this topic, is because it was still dominated by like the big multi-partner program like Payback and
Coalition programs.
The big coalition programs, and I mean you don't have the same amount of data as when you were running your own program. So that's why the big grocery retailers now, they do the same, like Rewe left, or do their own thing now. Rewe left Payback, or will leave Payback soon. So maybe we'll see some more personalization in the future when they have settled their programs and then start to do personalization.
Yeah, because I really think that proper personalization has to be closer to the brand. So a coalition loyalty program works well for doing discounts that make sense. So you see the coalition loyalty programs are creating rather large data sets, and if they're really wide, they know a lot about consumers. But what can they then use this knowledge for? They can use it for selling it basically to the partners of the coalition loyalty program. But then it's up to the partners to really to use this data, and so the coalition loyalty program works well for finding out who gets which offer. But really, it doesn't necessarily work so well for getting the creative messages across to the members that make them more loyalty towards the brands. So the messages that entail not so much an economic perspective, but more like a helpful perspective, like a tool for how they can make more value with the purchase that they just did. How can I get more functional value from the first time I buy into whatever, a new part of the inventory, first time I buy makeup? Then why not pause the campaigns for a while and teach me how to make the best of that? So functional value, or it could be experiential value, where I can get more experiences with the brand. So if I am, say that I'm a loyalty member of Quiksilver, then I can earn points for every wave that I ride, and I can use that use those points or save up, earn the right to actually have more experiences with Quiksilver that are related to Surf and such. I don't think you'd see that from a coalition loyalty program, because it's too far from the brand, and so it may be good for handing out the right vouchers, but not necessarily for actually creating that brand loyalty, that emotional loyalty that I think that most brands are really chasing these days.
That's a good point, a valid point. Yeah, but speaking of customer loyalty, the title of the today's podcast episode is Personalization and Customer Loyalty. So when we talk about this, how do you personally see these two topics go together? How does personalization and customer loyalty work together?
So luckily, I've had good conversations about this with other intelligent people. So I do believe that I have a fair idea of this. So first of all, remember that the whole idea of having a loyalty program in the first place was from a day where you didn't get data at a customer level in from the physical stores. So the idea of giving a few points or giving a reason for people to pick out their, to take out their, in those days, physical membership card and scanning that at the counter in order to make sure that the retailer knew who actually bought this product. So it wasn't just an anonymous purchase, but it were you could connect that to a customer. That was sort of, that was some of the reasoning for doing loyalty programs in the first place. And then you're left with all this data, and the data can either be used for optimizing the supply chain and optimizing the offers, optimizing the inventory, sort of optimizing the management of the business, but can also be used to optimize the way that you're communicating to each individual. So deciding which offers should we give to Michael now that he has bought these things in the past, and now that we know these things about his preferences and so on, then we can promote more easily the products and the offers that would make sense for Michael. And really, that's personalization. So that's one part of the reasoning for doing loyalty programs in the first place, what's actually to do personalization. And then in turn, the idea with personalization is that that should lead, and can indeed, if you do it properly, lead to more repeat purchases. So it leads to more loyalty. So that gets the flywheel spinning, because if you then have more purchases, that would create more data, and then you can personalize further and so on. So it's really a positive spiral if you are able to play it right.
Like, so really, you have to look it from both sides, and it goes together.
One thing feeds the other, and so it's like a positive loop.
Definitely. When you think about your own personal experiences, what's your own favorite example of personalization that you've experienced as a customer so far?
I'll mention, I think, two. So first one that I've actually experienced as a consumer is one of a, it's a health and beauty retailer here in Denmark called Matas. They have a wonderful loyalty program, and they do indeed know a lot about their customers. And for instance, they know which products that people generally tend to buy again and again. So products that are more eligible for repeat purchases. So that could be vitamin pills, for instance. So so they'll be looking into their database and seeing who is actually buying these products that are eligible for recurring purchases. And they'll be promoting the opportunity of signing a subscription for those particular products. I mean, they're doing a lot of other stuff, but really reaching out to people and with a convenient message asking people whether they'd like to actually save a bit of money by putting this product on subscription, because they're already buying this at regular intervals. Let's say that I signed the subscription for my vitamin pills. Then the initial fear of Matas was that when I then get these vitamin pills automatically delivered in my physical mailbox, and I'll get the vitamin jars, then I wouldn't need to come to the store, and the residual purchases, the add-on purchases that you normally do while you're in the store, then I would not necessarily do those. So what they decided to do is to put in some service communication before they're actually shipping the monthly shipment to me, saying that, listen, Rasmus, right now we're ready to make your shipment of a vitamin pills, and while the cardboard box is still there and it's open, why don't you add some of the things that you normally buy in there as well? So in that sense, it's a proactive service message, which so I'm led to feel comfortable and safe and acknowledge the fact that my goods will arrive, but I'm also asked to put in stuff that will make it further convenient for me. And they get this additional upsell that they might have otherwise missed out on if I didn't show up at the store.
So that's a really nice example. So they also do like kind of recommendations. So like this product could fit.
Obviously, taste, yeah. So it's not just any product that they then personalize and ask me to put in the basket. It's a mix up of stuff that I bought before. It's a mix up of things that I could be buying and could be interested in. And then also just, you know, small items that will, you know, sometimes there's the small items that you leave at the cash register, because people just, okay, yeah, let me just add some breath mints, let me just add some toothpaste or whatever, that'll just sneak into the basket really easily.
It's really, really nice example. And it also shows that it's not always about like hard selling, because you said it's like kind of a service message. Yeah. You as a customer feel that it's like a service message because they are thinking of you, like you're packing your box and you want to have additional, or you could need additional products.
And it's even sustainable because they are...
Yeah, it's not this classical hard selling selling
approach. And it works, it works fantastically. Yeah. So the other example was one that I saw that Discovery Networks / HBO did in Sweden. So they were, because these type of companies have the issue that if you sign up for sporting events to see, for instance, the Allsvenskan, which is the Swedish football league, then once the season comes to an end, then what do you then do? How can you retain these customers? Because they came for the football, so you need to get them hooked on something else before the season ends. So they did actually a personalized video where they were reaching out to people who were following the Swedish Football League, and they were sort of playing a game where they dressed up the video as if it were an interview with the people who are normally talking about the league on television. And they were doing it personalized with all the names, so that, hello, Michael, here you are in the studio, and blah, 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 and here we are here to help you set your team for the break period. And then the team was made up of TV shows that they wanted to recommend you to watch now that the football league was on break. So trying to do that cross sell in a fun and inspiring and untraditional way, I think that was a brilliant way of working with personalization, because it also had the idea of humor and surprise. And it was really tied into a core moment of truth in the customer experience.
Yeah, and it also shows that personalization is not only about product recommendations or like individual product offerings. It's also a lot about classical marketing, like creativity, right messaging.
Going back to my point about the fact that content has been neglected. No, it still has to be engaging and fun.
Yeah, definitely.
And never forget the content part of the bow tie there.
Yeah. I think this is the one of the points which is often missed, or which a lot of companies don't do really good. They are focusing on the technical stuff, like data and how do I do the right personalization of offerings, for example, but not on the creative part, like the classical or traditional.
And I think now's the time, honestly, because there's been, it's still a challenge to get proper hold and management of your data. It's still a challenge, but I also see that I see the light at the end of the tunnel, because that is clearing up, and we are getting more and better control of our data. And I think even that GDPR has made a huge favor towards personalization, because you're obliged by law to actually comply with GDPR. So indeed, many companies have much better control of their data than they used to have. So that's good. But then there's the other challenges as well. So there will be some people are under-investing, for instance, in the human resource side of things. So they don't, maybe because they don't, sell the hide before they shoot the bear. So really trying to make that business case and see, okay, looking at the ones who are best in class, how much extra should we be making if we were to actually have proper personalization in place? And then calculating backwards to see how much can it take for us? I mean, how much should we invest in this to make sure that you don't only invest in the tools? Because there are a lot of tech vendors that will tell you that if you just invest in the tools, then money will come out automatically. But I have yet to see, the marketing automation that will automate itself, or the personalization that would personalize itself. So really take it seriously that you have to invest in the people who can actually do this, both from a data and insight point of view, but also in the content side of things. So and not all these people you'll be needing full time or forever. So as you progress and as if you've established your platforms, then maybe you don't need to have these people in permanent positions. So that's why it also makes sense to see how you can employ agencies, and so really to leapfrog and make these investments come to fruitful personalization more quickly. I think a lot of people will be looking at the project cost from an agency, and maybe they'll be, we don't have the money for that. But really, if you've done the business case properly, then you already know what kind of money will be coming out of this. And quite often, there's plenty of money for both software and for headcounts, and also for the money that you'd be spending with agencies.
Mm. In my experience, is similar as you described. Is if I got it right now, in a nutshell, you said that the investment in technology is not the problem, and the technology itself is often not the problem. It's more like people skills, which is like the problem, and also maybe the content. Maybe this goes together with people and skills, because they have to do the content or to produce the content. This is often more the problem with companies, why they struggle or why they don't proceed that fast in personalization.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you imagine this as like two halves of the brain, and one is the inside side and one is the content side. So I'm reflecting. I'm going a bit away from the bow tie metaphor, but imagine that you met someone at a party and they were extremely insightful, but whenever they spoke, it was completely mechanical and only in non-inspiring and non-fun ways. That would come across as super creepy. Someone that knew everything about you and who showed it to you, but the way that they were communicating was iffy and not personal and not fun and not engaging. It would be a very short conversation because you wanted to run out the door. Or the other half, where you met someone who's just talking about inspiring stuff and fun stuff, but never listened to you and never paid any sense to what was interesting for you. That would also be maybe a fun conversation, but still a short one, because you'd quickly become bored and you wouldn't feel acknowledged. So really, that's where we need those two ends of the bow tie to come together in order to create those experiences where you'd actually want the customers actually want to stay with you, because they're feeling that they are being heard and seen and they're being valued and they're being acknowledged and spoken to as the individuals they are.
Well, slowly we're coming to an end. I have maybe one, not the last question, the second last, but one topic which is really omnipresent at the moment. I'm talking about generative AI, which is really, or which became a really huge topic in especially the last 1.5 to 2 years. What do you think personally? What changes in personalization with generative AI?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So first of all, I think it's important, and you already did that, to sort of separate generative AI from normal AI. So AI has been with us for many, many years, and it's been a fueling part of personalization from actually generating the insights. So AI has been used to, for instance, generate the segments or even suggest the segments based on different like behavioral segmentation or making like sort of algorithms or propensity scoring for which customers resemble which personas the most and so on. Or really trying to figure out what is the churn propensity for each customer, or what is the potential for one customer to buy into a new part of the assortment or whatever. So really, that algorithmic part of it, the predictive analytics part of that, has been working for us for a long time. Even also putting together the right ranking of products on the homepage. But the last part of the bow tie, which is the creative messaging, we haven't before seen actually AI helping us to create that. And that has been sort of the content problem. Because if you want to say that you have a campaign and you want to present that in many different ways to different audiences or different segments, then you'd have the extra cost of actually building these different types of content, whether it be like images or video or text. And now that is actually possible. You can use generative AI to create at least a draft, something that is very will fast get you from 0 to 90 kilometers an hour. But if you want to run 120 miles an hour or kilometers an hour, 150 even on the German Autobahn, then you would then you probably need to take it the last round by yourself. So I think that the dream here is that eventually the personalization can run on autopilot, at least for some parts of the customer journey or some parts of your marketing automation. So you wouldn't only brief the or prompt the generative AI based on your segments and based on your moments of truth and your goals with each end customer, but you'd simply brief or prompt the generative AI with the full data set that you have for an individual, and making the Gen AI decide what to say to them and how to say it and actually say it. And so I think that's the dream, and that's a target that we'll gradually come closer to. But I also see, so if this is in the self-driving car of marketing, then I think it's worth sort of also thinking about for how many years have we actually almost had self-driving cars. We almost had them for quite some years now, because we really don't want to see that traffic accident happen where the AI is to blame and then who really gets the blame. So so I don't think it's time yet to run marketing on full autopilot. I think we can have more and more of it run on autopilot, and we gradually come closer to that place where we can let AI actually generate and create the content that will engage our customers and indeed help us make it more creative and fun and making more variants for more segments. But full autopilot, I don't think we'll see that just yet. But hopefully we'll get closer to that. And I'm personally super psyched about the opportunities that we're getting, but also we're having a holding back with a bit of skepticism. I don't really want a traffic accident, even though it's on email, with my customers, where suddenly they are, you know, presented with an offer that we basically don't want to follow up on, or talking to people in ways that are rude or inappropriate or whatever. So right now, brands that are particular about their brands will still have to review any single piece of content that would actually go out. So that's where I see Gen AI happening. But as I mean, we also have clients in that actually, for instance, having Gen AI record or write the copy, completely unique copy in abandoned basket emails, depending on what they know about a customer and what they actually left in the basket. So indeed, some things can be put on autopilot, and that is happening now. So
That's interesting. Yeah. But when I bring it back to what you just said, bring back to your Bowtie framework. So you say the left-hand side, like the data insight side, this was there a long time ago or since many years, like this is the classical classical predictive AI part, which comes in there. And now Gen AI is coming on the on the right hand side, like on the content hand side,
especially the top right, because the content is already produced for the content feeds. The content is already there. That's the whole idea of content feeds. So that would be your product recommendations or article recommendations in a news site, or the songs that Spotify comes up with in a custom playlist or whatever. So that is the content is already there. So you don't need generative AI to create that, but you need Gen AI to create the content that is the messages. And that's what Gen AI can now help with.
Okay, now really coming to the last question and slowly to an end of today's episode. If you have to do some recommendations for your clients, for some companies, what be your like most important recommendations for a company that wants to start with personalization? Yeah.
That's the answer is long, and you could write a whole book about that, and I actually did. First of all, so ask yourself, do we have the prerequisites for actually succeeding with personalization? So depending on where you are as a company and how much customer data you have available, how frequent your customers interact with you, and whether you actually either already have or you have the opportunity of getting to know your customers through data collection. If that isn't the case, then fix that thing first before really investing a lot of money in personalization technology, for instance, and in personalization consultants and whatever. I would say if you're still unknown as a brand, if you're still unknown as a company, if you haven't positioned yourself, if you haven't created demand, then do that first, because that will allow you to actually get the data that you'd be needing for personalization. And even before that, make sure that you have your proper go-to-market fit dialed in. So you have your core business in place, that you have your core business concept and whatever. So if you spend too much time doing personalization on a business concept that you will ultimately change all of, then you'll be having to throw out a lot of effort into that. So fix those things before really getting into personalization, I would say.
Okay, that's good points. And so everybody out there, consider this recommendation from Rasmus. And if you want further information about personalization, then of course, read the book, Hello First Name.
Yeah, I'll listen to the book.
Yes, Rasmus, it was really a pleasure having you on this Loyalty Talk podcast episode. And thank you very much for your time and also the valuable insights about personalization. and we'll see you soon. Thank you, Rasmus. Goodbye.